From RunAsRadio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Nguyen announcing show number 382, Defining DevOps with guest Alan Sharp Paul, recorded Thursday, July 24th, 2014. Run As Radio is produced each week by PWOP Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Alan Sharp Paul, who's the co-founder and co-CEO of ScriptRock, makers of the cloud-based configuration monitoring platform Guardrail. And he's a web developer by trade, spent many more years than he'd care to admit working in corporate IT at companies like Expedia, Lloyd's, and the CBA. Welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
And a transplanted Aussie, too. How did you find yourself in California? How could such a thing have happened to a perfectly civilized Australian?
Well, we actually, when we had the original idea for the company, we applied to and were accepted into an incubator in Australia called StartMate. So I'm not sure if there's one out here called Y Combinator in the States that
sure.
is very popular. And so it's a very similar model, obviously far less known. And they have a very US focus. So, you know, they suggest, you know, they don't insist, but they suggest it might be a good idea to, you know, incorporate in the US, because part of the program, actually, when you finish the graduation of sorts, is, you come out to the States, you pitch your idea, at various events and to various VCs. And then hopefully, and as we were fortunate enough to happen, you get funding. And then, you know, after that, it just made sense, especially for this type of company. You know, if you're a tech company and you can make it happen, you can get yourselves out, to the Valley, then, you know, it is the place to be.
It is. Yeah. Everything's there. And accelerators, they give you a little bit of money. It's basically to help you get started. Have you actually gone and taken like an A round or anything?
Not yet. So that's something that's coming. We did a seed round. Yeah.
Right.
Although, you know, the seed rounds of today are kind of the A rounds of 5 years ago. So there's
you're totally right. And I think it's two things. A, they tend to put in more money, and B, you need to spend less money.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, obviously, you know, anyone can start a company these days. It really is very, 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 very cheap to get off the ground. Doesn't make it any easier,
sure.
but, no. So it makes it easier to start. Doesn't make it any easier to be a success, I don't think. But certainly the barrier to entry for people these days is very low. And I think, you know, you're seeing more and more people, in my position, which was I can't pretend I was born an entrepreneur. I can't pretend that I got out of school or got out of uni thinking, I'm got to start my own company. But you know, 10 years working in, or probably longer, 10, 12 years working in corporate IT, and, you know, one day we kind of spotted a problem and thought, you know what, this group, this accelerator believes in us. So maybe we should believe in ourselves a bit and, you know, give it a go.
It's really an interesting process, the way that stuff's built these days. And it sounds like you were a perfectly civilized web developer at one point in your life. What went wrong?
I didn't get too many delusions of grandeur. I did take the, you know, make the move into solution architecture at one stage, and it was probably all downhill from
right.
there. I didn't enjoy. I apologize if there are any architects out there, but I didn't. When you go from being a web dev, where you kind of, you know, you've presented a problem, you build a solution, you watch people interact with your solution. It's very, you know, it's probably a little bit pretentious to call it, you know, it's like a craftsman, but you know what you've done at the end of the day. You can point at it and, you know, people can interact with it. It might not be, you know, real as, you know, it's not a table, but you know, it's something you can see. And then you move into architecture where basically no one really sits you down and explains, hey, your life for the next 6 months is going to be this Word document. And you kind of
right.
like, and progress is, you know, I've added a few more dot points to section 3.4.2 of the technical reference document that I was working on today. And it wasn't for me. I probably lasted about, you know, about 18 months as an architect, and then I couldn't take it any longer.
Yeah, it's a battle, but you know, ScriptRock seems to sit neatly into this space of getting people into the DevOps space, which I think is even an odder world, because now you're really straddling the line between, you know, development and architecture live in one world, operations tend to live in another. Like, and I've read your blog post around trying to define DevOps, and I really appreciate how broadly you have sort of have to step back and look at it.
Yeah, it's a, I mean, you know, some people talking about, you know, has it jumped the shark? You know, what stage are we in the hype cycle now? I mean, everyone's kind of jumping on board this year, and, you know, terms like enterprise DevOps are being thrown around. We appreciate, and you know, we truly believe there's a lot of benefit floating around, but it is a pretty poorly defined area. It can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and that's probably part of the risk. I mean, there's many companies selling DevOps, and look, you know, I don't want to cast stones from inside my glass house. Like we use the term,
yeah.
You know, we kind of have to. The way I try to explain, like, if I have to explain DevOps to someone who has, you know, kind of is quite fresh into it, or really, you know, has maybe spent a week researching it and has gotten no closer to the truth, is it's about collaboration, and it's about automation. And there's a lot of other things, but if I really want to simplify it, it's about that. It's about, you know, how do we get our different teams, and not just DevOps, but, you know, security, you know, testers, everyone, you know, how do we get them to collaborate better? And then automation. So there's many benefits to be gleaned from automation. If you're wasting your time doing things manually that could be automated, then of course there are massive gains to be made. But that's a very high level overview. But that's kind of our focus. That's how we look at it. There are many other elements, but I think if you're talking about, you know, continuous integration, continuous delivery, if you're talking about automation, i.e. config management automation, so your chefs, your puppets, DSCs, your Ansible, then I think in most cases it's better to use those terms rather than to just generify it with, hey, we're doing DevOps now, because you're stepping away from the truth, and I think you're confusing things a little bit.
So focus in on the piece you're actually doing, because DevOps is a much broader concept.
It is, yeah. I mean, people talk about, you know, I think saying we do DevOps, it doesn't make any sense. You can't say we do DevOps. I prefer to look at DevOps as it's a tool set. It's a group of ideas. It's a group of processes, a group of sort of understandings that you should look at your existing business. And, you know, say you're a business that is already leveraging something like ITIL, and you've got a whole bunch of processes defined, and, you know, it's working for you. Maybe it's a little bit more rigid than you'd like. Look at what DevOps can offer. You know, look at CI/CD, look at automation, think about how you can improve collaboration, but then try and apply it, you know, to what you already have, the processes you already have in place. Don't sort of say, well, we did ITIL, but now we're going to do DevOps and expect that everything's just going to change, because DevOps is not that prescriptive.
Well, and I don't see the two as mutually exclusive either. ITIL speaks to operations as a service.
It does. And I mean, if you look at all the books, I think almost everything that DevOps talks about is covered in some way, shape, or form by ITIL. Again, I always look to simplify things. For companies that are using ITIL, and I've seen companies that went from nothing to ITIL, and that transformation, I mean, that can be amazing, because it goes from the Wild West.
Sure.
I mean, the DevOps, I guess, you know, we like to joke about DevOps hipsters kind of look at ITIL and say it's far too, you know, it's too rigid, you know, it's ridiculous, right. You know, they're not deploying enough. It's handcuffs. I can't deal with that. But again, I try to simplify it by saying, well, if you're using ITIL, consider DevOps a means of process improvement. So have a look at your change process. So, hey, you've got all these standard changes going through your change management process. Could we automate any of these standard changes? Because, look, they don't need approval. Why don't we look and see if we can automate those? And then automatically you've gained something there. Or you're even looking at the way people are collaborating as part of incident management. They always joke about, hey, start giving developers pages. That's a pretty good way to get developers to, you know, to have a little bit more interest in the stuff they're breaking. And again, that's a DevOps mindset, but you apply it to your incident management process.
That's Adrian Cockcroft's quote, right? When we started calling the developers at 3 a.m. for outages, there was a lot fewer outages.
Exactly. And that's not something you'll read in an ITIL book, but that's certainly an idea that gets kicked around quite a lot within DevOps. So again, there's no DevOps manual. There's no books like there are in ITIL. It's not like, well, we're maturity level zero for DevOps. Let's work our way up through 1, 2, 3, 4. I think you really just need to look at it, but look at it through the lens of what you already have and think, how can these things make us better? And, you know, prioritize, right. Look for quick wins, start small. The usual stuff. It's project management. There's nothing really new. It's just this collection, you know, it's collecting all these things together under a single term, which can be a good thing, but, you know, it can also be a dangerous thing as well.
Do you get pushback from folks about going faster?
We do. And I'd probably say we push back in a certain extent, because the way we've, and it's our experience with, you know, configuration management and automation in particular, and I don't like to focus in on it, but I think in general, when a lot of people think about what tool can I buy or what tool can I implement to help me do DevOps, they immediately go to automation. So they jump straight to that and they're saying, well, look, you know, it's a bit of a mess here. We've got configuration drift. We don't really have a good handle on things. You know, all our code, we all have these automatic test suites running now, but, you know, on the conf and the infrastructure side, you know, not so much. Things are breaking. It takes us ages to find, you know, to find the solution. And then they look out there and they go, oh, well, DevOps is good. DevOps is automation, which a lot of people will still kind of consider. Let's do automation. And they want to move fast by leaping straight into automation, which sounds like, and if you do automation brilliantly and perfectly from day one, of course it is an amazing thing. But if you leap straight to automation, that is a very, very steep learning curve to get up to go up. I mean,
right.
For a start, these tools are not easy to use. I mean, let's be honest. And a lot of them they've grown out of open source. They've grown out of the more Nix-based, which is not to say they don't apply to Windows, but they certainly weren't built with Windows in mind. And, you know, I've experienced it myself. We ran a large chef project at a trading firm in Australia, and the project went quite well, the implementation itself, but when it came to the ongoing maintenance, I mean, we had to stand in front of, you know, .NET developers and say, hey guys, you got to learn Ruby now so we can help you manage your Windows servers. And they thought that was hilarious. I remember one guy literally just went, he literally, what's it written in? It's Ruby. And he just said, I'm a .NET dev. And he just walked away. And, you know, in some respects, I can't blame him. Like, you don't. Why should I have to learn, you know, why should I have to learn Ruby to manage my Windows servers? It doesn't make sense. Now, you can get there, but it is, yeah. So there's a learning curve on the technology front, first of all. So that's one reason why rushing headlong into it can cause you problems. But secondly, there's a couple of key steps that people don't realize. They think, okay, we want to do automation. So really, what's the number one thing we have to do? Let's put out an RFP, or, you know, let's just do several proof of concepts for these three automation providers that we can have. And they launch into that and focus very much on the tech and skilling up and the training.
Buy a tool.
Yeah, exactly. The tool.
I want DevOps in a box.
Oh, you have to Google our DevOps in a box video. We did a, I'll just put that out there.
Oh, did you really?
We did a parody video called DevOps in a box.
Oh no, because I'm sure that I've seen ads for DevOps in a box as well, and it makes me cringe.
There is a company, I won't name them. There is a company that uses it. They actually got in touch after we made the parody video, and they wanted us to do some co-marketing on something else. So I can't remember what happened with it, but we found that rather amusing. But yeah, definitely Google DevOps in a box. And Scriptrock, if you want a bit of a laugh. It was based on a rather inappropriate Lonely Island video featuring Justin Timberlake from a few years ago, but I won't go into any more detail. I'll let your listeners check that out for themselves.
For sure. That's hilarious. But yeah, I mean, the reach for a tool reflex worries me, because so much of this is, like you said, about collaboration first.
Exactly, and understanding. So that's the other thing we found. So when we did this, it was a really, really large, it was a nightmare project, to be honest. Like, it was, you know, 80 odd apps, it was hundreds of servers.
Wow.
The way we were doing it was, we were basically ticking things off, like, have you automated this server? No, quick, go automate it. Have you automated this server? No, quick, go automate it. Now, the thing we found, though, was that the largest and most difficult part of an automation project, it's skilling up is one thing, deciding on your tool, okay, fine, they're things you need to work out, but it's actually gathering the requirements that's the hard part, because, you know, when it comes to configuration and automation, like, you know, how many, you can't go into that many shops these days and go, do you know the exact state of all your servers? Can you say on heart that this server is running this version of this app? That you know, and how many of these servers actually map to this stack of Word documents you've got in the corner that tells you how to build them and how they should be built? And of course, no one, No one can answer that. I mean, people can't even answer.
Right.
I've got a very simple environment. I've got two IIS, clustered IIS web servers in front of a SQL server. Are those two clustered servers configured exactly the same way? Now, most people will answer, yeah, sure.
Sure they are.
But, if you dig down, you'll find, okay, the patch levels are slightly different. This one's running a slightly different, version of this particular package. The web.config files are, they're not getting pushed up because they're not in change control. But as a result, people have been hacking around and, this one's got directory browse turned on. Oops. Let's quickly turn that off. But gathering all those requirements and trying to, get to a point where you've got an automation script that you can say hand on heart, this is how these servers should be built. That is a really, really hard thing to do. And I think that's one of the key things that people underestimate. And so we actually say when we're presenting, our tool to some people, you need to slow down. Because the first thing they'll say to us is they'll say, we're doing automation now. We're going into that.
Okay. Right.
Okay. Do you have a good handle on what you have? Can you point at one of your servers and say, this server is currently in a good state? And the answer is always no. So we found this out. And then, so when we started building Guardrail, we thought, well, look, automations, and to be completely frank, when we first went into that accelerator I mentioned earlier, we actually had it was a twin tool. Part of it was supposed to be doing the automation, and part of it was supposed to be doing validating configuration. Now, we looked at the automation space after we joined that accelerator and went, you know what, it's a knife fight. There's 20, 30 providers, there's more getting added every day, and this was in the last year. We sort of looked at it and went, you know what, let's focus on this part. Let's focus on the validation piece because no one's really doing that. Now, over time, what we realized was missing in front of that was actually a discovery and a scanning piece.
Yeah, I was thinking monitoring, actually knowing what's going on in your systems is the most important piece.
Absolutely. So we break it into, this is a bit marketing speak, I apologize, but we break it into three waves. And we actually see the third wave of sort of getting a grip on your configuration as being the automation piece. So we see that as the third part. The first part is actually discovery and visibility. So it's like, what do I actually have? Because I might have, 10 servers, 20 servers, 30 servers, thousands. It doesn't really matter. Generally, you want to have a really good grip and really good handle on what you have. So the first part of what Guardrail does, all you need to do is basically connect your servers up to the platform, is just discovery. So you connect up, we go down, you can configure and manage. So for example, if you want to target specific directories, registry keys, if you want to scan SQL databases as part of the scan, you can do that as well.
Yeah.
In general, what it will pick up is packages, services, environment variables, users, groups, ports that are in use. So all your general state and conf, it will just pull that up, bring it up, allow you to visualize it. So we have, we basically display it in a, hard to describe it, a wheel format, which basically shows you, all the different conf you have. And then on top of that, you can actually start differencing it too. So if you do have, two clustered web servers or even, 10 clustered web servers, you can actually say, well, these should be the same. Look, the first thing we're going to do is scan each of them, find out what's on them. And then we're going to run differencing to go, oh, wow, look, that, that web.config file is different. And hey, we're running a completely different version of this package. And this service that should be running is stopped. And, this hotfix that we've been told by security we absolutely need to have on all our IIS servers, is actually not in place. So that's the first part for us. So actually discovering, visualizing, and also allowing you to visually difference the state and really get a handle on configuration drift. Because the surprising thing for us has been talking to even some guys that are running 3,000, 5,000 server farms. We say, what is your number one problem from a configuration perspective? And they say drift and visibility. They say, I don't have a good handle on drift. And I really don't know, what's out there.
When I'm thinking that, Microsoft makes some tools in this space, and I'm thinking about stuff like MAP, the assessment and planning app, but it's sort of a one-time run, right? I mean, it's free. You can't argue for the price tag, but it's really meant to assess a system before you migrate to something else.
Exactly.
For drift, you have to run this thing routinely and look for differences.
And that's exactly what we do. And yeah, my understanding of MAP is a little bit more data center planning style, but absolutely.
Yeah.
What you're doing once you connect a server with Guardrail, by default, we will scan that box every single day. And then if you do nothing else other than connect it, we'll say, hey, by the way, if in this particular environment, on this server stopped running. On this server, this package was installed. On this server, someone changed the environment variable. And we'll just track will track drift, for you and allow you to basically say, well, now let's compare these two servers or this group of servers to see what the drift is like between them as well, because the default drift is monitoring what changes on a per server basis. And I should point out as well, we do Windows, we do NICs, but we also do network devices, so we can do the same thing for, ACLs, et cetera, as well.
Nice. Well, what's interesting about this is when I've gotten involved with organizations where we want to get better, and I resist tools pretty heavily, but so you start on the cultural conversation. We do the whiteboard with post-it note things just to see what everybody's doing.
Yep.
And that's sort of a monitoring of people's behavior. When you make changes, when we are in a firefight, when new features get deployed, all those sorts of things. Just creating visibility into the work that's done every day. And naturally, from visibility comes improvement. As soon as you can see it, you start seeing dumb things that could be better and you fix them. And so if you just provide visibility to how my servers are drifting, how my servers are actually each day, I will make them better.
Exactly. And I think you hit the nail on the head as well by bringing collaboration into it, because the other thing we realized, for me, it's one of the two pillars of DevOps is the collaboration angle. If you think about what is the one area in IT that almost everyone has their finger in the pie, and it's configuration. So the impacts of code changes, like your security guys and your the ops guys and girls, they'll care about that as well. But configuration is the one piece that everyone not only is impacted by, but also changes. So the typical thing the developer, there's that classic DevOps meme out there, worked fine in dev, not my problem, worked fine in dev, ops problem now with the kind of burning, the burning building behind the little girl. But that's the thing, because the developers will go, well, these are our environments and we will change whatever we want to get this thing working. We want this setting on, we want this setting off, we're going to do that. Toss it over the fence. Okay, nothing works now. Why doesn't it work? Well, because we're ops and, we know what we're doing when it comes to this stuff, and we can't have that on. We can't have this on. You can't use this package. And then, all right, we've got that sorted now. Let's get ready to throw it into production. And the security guys go, whoa, hold on a second. We can't use this. We can't use that. You need to make sure. So everyone has a stake in configuration. But the problem is that it's always an after the fact.
Right. After the code is written.
Exactly.
This needed to be a conversation at the beginning.
Which it may be, but what is the medium that it's a conversation at the beginning? Hey, we're security and you're developers. Here's our security guidelines Word document. It's 343 pages long. Just make sure that anything you do adheres to these standards. Developers take one look at it, start using it. I don't know, maybe they raise their monitor up another 5 inches. Using it, but they can't. They just don't have enough time to abide by it. So the second part of, I guess what Guardrail does is the validation piece, and, it's through what we call policy. So effectively in the first part, you can build a policy from scratch. So even if you're not doing discovery, if you know your system so well that you can say, I need this package, I need this hotfix, this environment variable should be set to that, I need this setting within this config file, this flag should be turned on, then you can build a policy from scratch and you can start, policies within Guardrail are executable. And you can schedule them as well. So you can say, here's my policy for my, SQL 2K8. And you can start running it against all SQL 2K8 servers on a continual basis when they're added, et cetera. But if you've got the scans as well, what you can actually do is you can take the scan and you can filter and curate it down and say, well, this is the stuff I really care about. And you can actually automatically turn that into a policy. But the beautiful part about it is that different groups can go through that process themselves. The security guys can go, okay, here's the scan of this server. All right, well, this is what I care about, and I can see three or four things are missing. I'm going to add those in as policy checks as well. Here's my security policy for this server. And then the ops guys do the same thing. They go, well, here's this version of this package, and that's not standard, and yep, this is the patch level we need to be at. Here's our version of the policy. And then the apps guys can come along and go, well, functionally, like, I don't actually care about all that stuff. Functionally, this is what is important. This is what this app needs to run. So I'm going to create a policy for that. And those three policies then get combined and basically applied to the server so that at any one point in time, you don't have to ask the question, hey, security guys, can you have a look at this server and make sure you're happy with it? They just say, well, is the security policy passing for that server? They say, yep, it is. And the ops guys, same thing. Is the ops policy passing? It is. Is the app policy passing? It is. And everyone knows. So that the medium now for communicating and collaborating and enforcing compliance in terms of configuration is now actually an executable.
Because policy is such a broad concept here. It's like there's a lot of different things you need to measure to really know. It's very tough to say, is that secure? Well, it's compliant with the policy.
Correct.
But what is the policy actually able to measure?
Correct. And I think that kind of segues nicely into the typical workflow we see customers go through is that they'll actually start purely with the scans. And then the first question we'll ask is, okay, what are the things that cause you the most grief on these servers? And they'll say, well, it's always this service. It's always this package. People are constantly playing with this configuration file when they shouldn't be. And so you add, so that the policy building is, it's very much kind of an incremental or on an organic kind of growth type of thing. So they will evolve over time. Ideally, you're as proactive as you can be with the policies. But in many cases, and the bottom line is always, hey, if something breaks and it wasn't covered by a policy, the first question should be what check could we have had in place?
Right. What policy can we put?
Exactly.
But I also appreciate, in the old days, the way you would deal with this, you just lock everything down. Right. Which now security becomes business prevention. You get into this trap of it's locked down so that we don't violate policy, but we can't actually get anything done.
That's actually how the product name came about, because our theory is you don't want to lock people down, but you do need to give them guardrails. So it's like, hey, developers, go for your lives, but we've put these guardrails in place that you can do whatever you want to get your app working. But look, for X, Y, and Z reason, you can't do these things. You can't change this. You can't uninstall this. You can't use this version of the package. So they're the guardrails that have been put in place, but it's not, you can't touch this server at all anymore. It's like, absolutely, you can touch it. If you break something, we're going to find out. It's going to get triggered. But not only will we find out quickly, we'll also know exactly what to do to whack it back into place.
Provide some visibility.
Yeah, I'm going to have a conversation about it as well.
I've also been really keen on this approach of everybody working from the same template. All our operations machines are virtualized now. Most of testing, because we're starting to do it in cloud and thing, virtualized as well. So why not have the devs working in a virtual environment as well, where the template of that environment is coming from ops?
Exactly.
So, all that stuff's already applied to it. And my favorite part of that is when dev needs to make a change to it, which they do, they have that conversation at the beginning before they start using that new tool. It's like, I need to introduce this to the template. Now we can work through the security related issues and the operations issues, the scaling issues before there's a big commitment and development resources to it.
Absolutely. And you covered from a regression perspective as well, because those things that you knew were important 3 months ago and you've completely forgotten about now, they're still living on in that template, that policy you created.
Yeah, well, I like the template approach because instead of a Word doc, it's actually the working document. This is the thing you run to generate an instance. So it is the truth, because the truth is gets executed every day.
Exactly. And you get this, I've always described that it's like a virtuous cycle. It's your documentation, which in this case is the policy, tests your servers, but your servers also test your policies. Because often, the reason Word documents suck so much is that, well, they're out of date straight away. But often what people find is they'll go, hey, this doesn't match the document. And then they'll spend all this time realizing, well, actually, it's just that the document's wrong. But when things are executing and they're automated, your tests or your policy check your servers, but your servers validate your policies as well. And it becomes a very simple process to just go, well, yes, that failed, but you know what? It failed for a good reason, because we've actually made this change.
Yeah. Well, how many times have we had that debate? Is the app wrong or is the doc wrong? Right? Back and forth. Just knowing for sure that it's one. It can be either one, but which one.
Yep. Shortening those lengths of time from, well, what is actually wrong? Because it tells you straight away what's wrong. This is the thing that's failed. So yeah, let's now, like you said, sit down, have a conversation about it.
Yeah, and I like processes built that encourage collaboration. You know, by having ops own the template, because in the end, the only truth that matters is production, right? Where the customer actually hits the app is what matters. And so ops owns the template. It means anybody needing to change template talks to ops. So they talk about what it's going to look like in production up front. They've got to be open to the conversation. You've got to be able to make changes. If we can't deploy new features, it doesn't matter. But, you know, having that environment, having that process in place, I think helps cultivate that culture.
It doesn't. And we take it a step further because we actually say there's an overall template, but it's actually, it's modular in nature. If I'm a developer and I have something functionally I need to apply, I can add it to the functional part of the policy. And if it conflicts with something that the security guys or the ops guys have in their template, then it will fail over there. But the important thing is, right. Yeah, and again, this is for us a major problem with automation tools, is that quite frequently it's like, hey, we've just implemented tool X. It's going to manage all our configuration. I'm like, all right, cool. Who knows how to use it? And often, if you're lucky, it's one team know how to use it. In most cases, it might be one person in one team. Like the number of times we've heard, hey, we're using Chef. Yeah, how's it going? Well, we're not really using it anymore because the guy that knew it left. And it's like, wow, like really? And it happens a lot because there is this big learning curve. So for us and you know, being in the valley, like what we were doing got scoffed at for a long time because we, you know, it's UI driven. We want it to be accessible to everyone. From a policy perspective, you can customize them using, by creating your own templates, but everything else is template driven. So if I'm a tester and I know that an app needs connectivity from server A to server B, and I know enough to know, maybe I know the name of each server and I know enough to know how it's going to connect, that's all I need to know to create a check for that. Because I just choose the network connectivity template and I say, connect connectivity to this server by TCP should succeed. And I hit create. And then Guardrail worries about how to do that under the covers. You don't have to worry about that. But for us, like again, you know, we show that to the bleeding edge guys down here and like, oh, you know, I can do that using tool, open source tool X, Y, and Z. And we're like, well, that's cool. But, you know, what if you need your testers to use that? What if you need someone else in another team to use that? It's, you know, we're talking DevOps here. If you're talking DevOps without using a tool that allows people to collaborate, then, you know, I had one blog post and I called it Zero Sum DevOps. Because, you know, you're making massive gains on the automation side, but you're making equal losses on the collaboration side because everything is now being pushed into one area for management. And that's a big risk too.
It's awesome stuff, man. I like this idea of DevOps with guardrails. It's a good concept. How do we keep us on a safe track?
Cool. Yeah, and which is as we get into real businesses, not these, you know, not your three-man startups coming out of the valley. It's important because you need checks and balances. You don't always have the greatest developers in the world available. They need freedom, but they need guardrails too. They need to make sure that they're not stepping over the line.
Alan, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
It was fun. Thanks, Richard.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.